Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, a deep dive into the weird and wild world of the globe's biggest live streaming platform called Twitch.
Twitch connects people in such an unprecedented way that we're still trying to understand it.
In April, this professional streamer had more social media interactions than LeBron James, Cristiano Ronaldo, and Shaquille O'Neal, making him the most popular athlete in the world.
Hooked might be an understatement. This is one of those viral games that is literally sucking productivity out of schools, out of workplaces.
Probably most of them only tune in when there's a level of drama, like when my life's at a really unstable point.
I apologize to you guys, my sponsors and Twitch. I've been unfaithful. It's not what I represent.
Because you were watching someone think. It's almost as intimate as sex.
It's all coming up after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We start this hour with a meme and end it with a glimpse at a cultural revolution. The meme was on global display in the 38th minute of this summer's World Cup final, when baby-faced French forward Antoine Griezmann scored a penalty kick on Croatia.
A goal of its age, of its generation!
Griezmann danced. Holding an L to his forehead, he squatted as he kicked his feet out, left, then right, then left, then right.
Griezmann dances once again. France leads once again.
To many millions of young internet culture devotees, it was a triumphal allusion to Fortnite Battle Royale, a video game which has garnered some 125 million players and more than a billion in revenue in less than a year.
This is one of those viral games that is literally sucking productivity out of schools, out of workplaces.
With millions of users, from kids to even celebrities like Chance the Rapper, Joe Jonas, and Steelers wide receiver Juju Smith-Schuster caught up in the craze.
I'm at this party right now, and all I'm thinking about is Fortnite.
It's a fixation that some talking heads deem excessive.
The gamers buy a virtual currency, which they then exchange for items in the Fortnite shop. Outfits, dances, and some of these things can cost the equivalent of $20.
I am embarrassed to say that at one point I watched all of those dances on my computer to see what they were all like. What a waste of time.
Says who? Like all of us, she just bashes what she doesn't get. To her, it's just another menacing cultural manifestation, inexplicably enthralling an unfamiliar demographic. Happens all the time, as we know. The battle royale genre is like the Hunger Games. Your goal is to kill off opponents until you're the last one standing. Each match starts with 100 players parachuting down onto an island where they scavenge for guns, ammo, armor, and other resources. It's fast, but not gory. It's washed in shades of blue and green, purple and gold.
Unlike a lot of shooters, it's fun to look at. There's a lot going on in it. Kids started playing it on their phones. Adults are playing it on their consoles. Everyone was talking about it. And all of a sudden, Fortnite becomes the biggest thing on the internet.
Julia Alexander is a senior culture reporter with Polygon.com. She and her colleagues have chronicled myriad manifestations of Fortnite fever and the complicated politics surrounding a game that has drawn more than 500,000 viewers online simultaneously. That live streaming, that simultaneity, seems to be a crucial thing. Fortnite is not only fun to play, it's fun to watch and watch and watch.
They really want to watch someone who is extremely good at what they do, someone like Ninja.
An epic player with an antic sweetness, congenial patter, and a vast online community to whom he constantly talks.
Oh my
God! Stop!
God, that looks so clean, dude. Let's go.
Ninja, aka Tyler Blevins, stick thin, pink haired, 27 years old, Fortnite master, and an early adopter of Twitch, the internet's biggest live streaming platform. A camera fixed on his face makes his gameplay personal. You can't help but celebrate his wins or share in his disappointment.
No! Trap? Oh my God, he put a trap there?
Who put the trap there?
And you can comment on the game or anything else in a chat stream running down the side of the Twitch screen. If you donate to Ninja on Twitch, right then and there, he'll respond to your comments and questions as he's playing. For instance, offering candid advice about love and growing up.
Sure that, but then you just need to be like, I really feel like I'm putting in more effort in this relationship, and then I feel like you are. I feel like I just want to make sure that you're just as invested in this as I am. Don't think so lowly of yourself that you think you can only play video games and you can't succeed in something else. All you have to do is put time and effort into it. I guarantee if you stop playing video games as much as you are, then you won't be declining in school and you'll feel a lot better.
His twin gifts of dexterity and charisma have made him the most recognizable face of Fortnite and Twitch, a champion of the game and the platform, and of young boys everywhere. Also very rich.
Some Fortnite players who stream their games online like Ninja make up to $500,000 a month from subscriptions and endorsements.
In April, this professional streamer had more social media interactions than LeBron James, Cristiano Ronaldo, and Shaquille O'Neal, making him the most popular athlete in the world.
Ninja became the biggest streamer to the point where artists like Drake were actually messaging him on Instagram and saying, hey, can we hop on and play together? I really want to play. I want to hang out on Twitch. Their stream, which happened at like midnight, pulls in like 640,000 concurrent viewers.
Wow.
Sets a new record.
Thanks to the Drake bump, Ninja now reaches 10 million viewers, more than most TV networks. But our show this week isn't about Fortnite or Ninja. It's about the wider, weirder Twitchoverse. You don't just get to talk to your gaming heroes in real time. You get to talk to all sorts of people in real life, the IRL precinct of Twitch, who live stream their pranks, binges, rages, and rambles via their cell phone cameras to you for connection and for cash. In an age of increasing social isolation, Twitch seems to offer an unfiltered human experience. The streamers, and their watchers, especially those with dollars to spend, can be kind or cruel. You can yank the streamer's strings for money. It's a potent entertainment. So this week's hour is devoted to Twitch.
I think what people really like about it, what I like about it, is it creates this parasocial relationship.
The term was coined to talk about an audience's lopsided connection with TV stars. It's an intimacy
times a million with Twitch streamers because they're talking to you about their relationship problems, their financial problems. They're talking to you about their anxiety and their highest moments. So people watch these streamers because they really think they know them.
Take the poignant character arc of Twitch streamer Dr. Disrespect.
Yeah, a very interesting man whose real name is Guy Beam, lives in California. He's a character pulled out of a 1980s WrestleMania match, mm-hmm. thrown onto Twitch and playing video games. On stream, he wears a fake mustache. He wears sunglasses. His whole shtick is based around his arrogance and his narcissism.
The athleticism, the maneuvers, the outstanding positive attitude on a daily basis. This is why I'm a successful video game machine in the online gaming community. Ladies and gentlemen, you are looking at the best.
Best.
Full athletic scholarship, traveled the world, millions and millions and millions of dollars, international video gaming conferences, red carpet premieres. Like, I've done it all.
Dr. Disrespect embodies one of the great contradictions of the gaming world. His stream seems to satirize boneheaded masculinity, and yet he suggests that his winking self-regard invites his community to expose their fragility, their real fears. Accepting the 2017 Esports Industry Award as Streamer of the Year, he said,
I get a lot of messages. People that deal with suicide, people that have fought in the war, people that are dealing with cancer. And I realize I've provided an outlet for a lot of people that are dealing with a lot of hardships. And it makes me proud.
A month later, Doc flipped his script and exposed his own pain and shame.
As you guys know, I have a beautiful family.
and a wife and kid. And I want to be transparent that I've been unfaithful.
As he confesses, you can find the video on YouTube, the Twitch chat mourns with him. Alongside his face flows a cascade of condolences and frowny face emotes, the Twitch version of emojis.
I'm going to take time off to focus on my family, and I apologize to you guys, my sponsors, and Twitch. This is not who I am. It's not what I represent. That's it.
2 months later, he staged a comeback, pulling in at least 30 grand in new subscriptions upon his much-hyped return. Genuine or phony or half and half, that kind of exposure in real time is found all across Twitch, layered on any number of video game universes. In a recent Fresh Air interview, film director and YouTube star Bo Burnham told Terry Gross that after watching hundreds of hours of vlogs made by kids, he came to understand that boys tended to talk about video games and girls tended to talk about their souls. After watching hours of Twitch, I'd argue that some streamers and viewers use video games to talk about their souls.
Put a 5 in the chat, please, if you've ever heard or played the game Fable. Now, Fable was such a good game.
Reverend Matt Souza of God Squad Church, what the Washington Post says may be the world's first online-only church for video gamers.
I got my spells, I got my weapons, but one thing that was so unique was you got to develop your character's character. One of our 5 core values here at God Squad Church is learning to have integrity as individual gamers here in the gaming community.
The gaming community, the lifeblood of Twitch, is about connection in a virtual house and parasocial relationships that exert real pull, even if they're almost entirely lopsided. You need only to look to the Twitch Gold Rush to see how powerfully it resonates.
It is a streaming network that has more viewers than HBO, ESPN, Netflix, and Hulu.
Amazon is buying Twitch TV for roughly $1 billion. Twitch is an emerging and powerful media platform with 55 million viewers every month watching other people play video games.
Because Twitch chat is both in-your-face personal and anonymous, it can also be a magnet for bottom feeders of the kind that prompts anxious analysis from legacy outlets like ours. And it's certainly true that a sizable share of Twitch contributes to the same primordial soup that spawned the troll army that terrorized women in the game world, the same soup that has nourished elements of the alt-right. But it's not all bad.
There are a lot of female gamers who are really happy on Twitch, but there's a large part of Twitch that ties into Gamergate, and it's like a large part of that ties into then federal politics. After Trump got elected and all these alt-right things were popping up, Ezra Klein at Vox was like, man, this connection to video games, who would have known? And my boss, who I think was on the show, Chris Grant, he's like, no, we told you that there's a fringe culture.
But less fringe with each passing day. The Twitch platform, so live and so intense, can be whatever each user decides to make it, including a boys' club, as Ninja has implicitly stated, by refusing to stream with female gamers as a matter of policy.
I tried not to play with females, man, just because of the image it presents. It's kind of just like, why would I want to even risk that image, right? Do you feel me?
If you are seen talking to a woman or playing with a woman, people are very quick to start making rumors. Oh, are they flirting? Are they dating? And because he's in a very loyal marriage, as he says, he doesn't want to be associated with any of those rumors.
Allegra Frank, Polygon News editor, recently reported on Ninja's exclusionary policy that men and women can't play a game together on Twitch's most popular stream, she says, not only denies female gamers access to an enormous audience, it sanctions an attitude that is as pernicious, or at least as Mike Pencean, as it is old.
It does inherently suggest, oh, women are sexual objects. You should not be seen with a woman who isn't your wife in a public setting, essentially, is going to influence these younger viewers to say, yeah, that makes sense. Of course, he's just being a good guy.
As a prominent and persuasive teenage boy whisperer, Ninja could play an active role in shaping our culture for the better.
Twitch connects people in such an unprecedented way that we're still trying to understand it. And I want people to start to see themselves as the role models that they often are for this generation. It's time to really just stand up and take responsibility for what you're doing and share that with people who need it, marginalized people.
4 years ago, Twitch already was a peak source of this country's internet traffic. We didn't notice. We finally have, because this is really new. Communication, one to many and many to one, for free or a nominal fee, with champions and with ordinary people. The intense buzzing of a hive mind. It's powerful. Streamers and viewers say it feels realer than real life, and maybe that's because now there's virtually nothing that separates the two. Now that's entertainment.
This is On the Media.
This is Brooke. When you've finished listening to OTM this week, why don't you head over to the New Yorker Radio Hour? David Remnick sat down with Jerry Seinfeld, who just directed his first movie about Pop-Tarts.
Did you really like Pop-Tarts all that much growing up?
Oh, yeah.
How about now?
Still, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, love them.
That's a good breakfast for you?
I eat it after a bad show on a Wednesday night.
Listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So do what Brooke says. Come join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's hard to overstate just how enormous the Fortnite Battle Royale craze has been. But amid all the media gawking, one detail has generated almost universal incredulity.
And now mastering the game may even get you a college scholarship.
What?
That's what they're telling me.
Now, Ashland University in Ohio will offer scholarships to the best Fortnite players in the world. They're part of the National Association of Collegiate Esports and recruit gamers the way they recruit athletes. Did you know they had that?
Yes, video gaming aims to be seen as a pro sport like any other. The Major League Gaming Corporation, MLG, draws huge viewerships for the highest levels of Halo, Dota, and Super Smash Bros. Competition, and this year commenced the most extravagant esports undertaking so far, a 12-team pro circuit called the Overwatch League.
A global world-class esport league designed from the ground up to celebrate the best of the best on their path to victory.
They're playing for a lot of money, and they play in front of thousands of people. They get a $50,000 minimum base salary, healthcare, and retirement benefits as well. I find this incredible.
People just have different experiences of pop culture.
Cecilia D'Anastasio is a senior reporter for Gizmodo Media's Special Projects Unit and for its video gaming publication, Kotaku.
I don't watch traditional sports. I never have. I don't care about it. If someone talks to me about sports, I just close off my brain and I think about Overwatch.
Since the league's launch in January, she's followed all 12 Overwatch teams from the U.S., China, Korea, and the U.K. She's taken special interest in her local team, the powerhouse New York Excelsior, which dominated the competition in the inaugural season. Now, OTM didn't get onto the Overwatch League till late in the regular season and with the playoffs beckoning, so we turned to D'Anastasio to get up to speed. Newbies like us are a sort of occupational hazard for an esports journalist. You know, oblivious outsiders who just can't seem to get their heads around the idea of professional digital sports.
Whoever wins the playoffs at the Barclays Center wins.
Wait, what? The Barclays Center. The basketball arena in Brooklyn where the Nets play. That's where the playoffs are?
Correct.
And people are paying money to go in and watch people play video games?
Everyone I know.
And the winner gets what?
$1 million.
So a couple of months ahead of the grand finals, we set out to understand what would be taking place in the Barclays Center and across the world via smartphone, including an outpost 7,000 miles east of Brooklyn. In Seoul, South Korea. This is 22-year-old Chung Yul Pak, better known by his gamer tag, Sabiolbi, which is derived from a poem he once wrote about a night of shooting stars. 2 years ago, Sabiolbi, on medical leave from the military and dividing his time as a barista and as that guy on the couch playing video games, saw an ad that changed his life.
An elite international task force charged with ending the war and restoring liberty to all nations. Overwatch. Soldiers. Scientists. Adventurers. Oddities. Guardians who secured global peace for a generation.
Now he threw himself into Overwatch, inhabiting the game character, or hero, known as Tracer, a speedy, bespectacled British woman firing pistols akimbo. Sabiolbi's Tracer was so lethal and so inventive, word quickly spread in the Overwatch universe.
The world could always use more heroes.
Actual professional offers started coming in, and with them, a dilemma. Because in Korea, as here, parents are trying to get their kids off of the console, not on it.
To convince your parents when you're a teenager that training the necessary 6 to 8 to 10 hours a day to become good enough at Overwatch to join the league is very difficult.
Furthermore, the professional lifespan is not a long one. It's an industry that has 20-year-old retirees with no college degree and, well, let's just say, limited life skills. And this is a sport for which revisions to a game, called patches, can be published in the middle of a season, requiring teams to master new tactics, new skills. And what happens when the dominance of a professional player's game is usurped by the next popular game, or the next? In a conversation through a translator, I asked Sabiolbi just that.
개인적으로는 나이가 들어서는
He's confident that he can play longer, like he can play until like late 20s, maybe like 30s. But if Overwatch becomes obsolete, then he can probably go to other games, maybe be a coach, whatever popular game it is at that time. Or if that doesn't work out, he can always go back to being a barista.
He did sign with the Korean team Luxury Watch Blue. With such other star players as Libero and Pine, Luxury Watch Blue became a standout team in the league. And Sabiolbi, poetically enough, was its shooting star.
Sabiolbi was so loved and so respected because in addition to being the most dangerous Tracer player, he just comes off as this really nice guy. He has this beautiful wife whose photograph he puts on his keyboard while he's playing, he said, so he can cherish her while he's winning all of these games.
Talent and charisma, which made him an obvious recruitment target when the Overwatch League was developing and American investors came a-scouting. But not just Sabiolbi. The Americans, as we often do, bought in bulk.
In New York, we want to win because that's what New Yorkers want to do.
Farzam Kamel is a partner at Sterling VC, the investment arm of the company that owns the New York Mets and which founded the Overwatch League's New York team.
So our strategy was we were going to look for an intact roster of players who've had continuity playing together with success and ideally coaches that come along with them who've had experience playing with them.
Esprit de corps. The few, the proud, the excelsior.
Exactly.
This was not a trivial investment. Apart from payroll and benefits, there's the cost of entry. The Overwatch League is owned lock, stock, and pixel by the game publisher Blizzard Activision, which charges very, very not pretend franchise fees. Cecilia D'Anastasio.
To buy into the Overwatch League costs $20 million for season one. And for season two, it's been reported by ESPN that the price for an Overwatch League team is going to be $30 to $60 million. And I'm saying this of Sterling VC. I think that the greatest New York virtue might be just having enough money to buy whatever the hell you want.
Including the best esports team ever assembled.
Correct.
Sure enough, the fans were just smitten from the Excelsior's first game in January against the Boston Uprising.
There was one moment that happened when This player, his name is Pine, was debuted on stage for the first time. He was playing this hero McCree, kind of this cowboy hero who has a revolver.
He's so aggro on this McCree.
And like a grown adult popping balloons at a kid's fair, he just exploded five heads with just beautiful poise.
I can't even finish my sentence before he kills someone else.
All just in the span of a few seconds, everybody was screaming.
This is unreal.
Everybody in Twitch chat was spamming all of these emotes, and that was the moment when people were like, this is the team to be reckoned with.
And so it went all season.
Beautiful play from Sabiobi, millisecond kind of reactions. And it's a wipeout. Boston Uprising, they're getting run over. If you're Boston, you're wondering what deity you have wronged here, and I'll tell you the answer. Sabiobi is the god you have wronged here.
Pine with three.
Pine with four.
Are you serious?
Beautiful. This guy's a living highlight reel, man.
Actually, it was Sabiobi's teammate, Pine, who emerged as the big hero of game one. And by the July playoffs, he was a superstar. He's 20. Pine, what is fame like?
It feels good to be famous and to be recognized, but because I became famous because of my skills, I feel an immense amount of pressure to perform well in games.
Pine, do you dream in Overwatch?
Actually, I dream about women recently.
Well, the feeling's mutual.
I'm literally dying. The players just walked in and we're all like, ah! They're all really good looking.
I'm so happy.
I was an arm's length of touching them.
Haley and Alice are college students and active gamers in the Rutgers University Esports Club. We met them at one of the team's local meetup events, which draw a diverse and passionate crowd.
They've proved they were number one. They're far ahead of even second place is far behind them. And we couldn't be prouder of our boys.
On the night of the big semifinal against the Philadelphia Fusion, 500 supporters packed the 4040 Club, a sports bar owned by Jay-Z, to Twitch watch the live stream. One was Richard Ng, screen name Great Root Bear.
And I'm the founder of the Five Deadly Venoms, the supporters club for NYXL, a team that set records for the whole year, brought this whole city together. And has a lot of people invested in it, so we'll see. You'll see something very special here tonight for our playoff game against Philly. I can tell you, if New York pulls off the win, this building will explode in a good way. If they go down, though, there will be a moment where you could hear a pin drop. Might be a couple tears, but that's the beauty of the game here.
Note the apprehensiveness. Because of a software revision or patch imposed late in the season by the game's publisher, Overwatch had actually changed. A new character had been introduced, diminishing the importance of Sabiobi's hero, Tracer. It was something like baseball changing the height of the pitcher's mound in September.
Yes, they absolutely dominated the regular season. But coming into the playoffs, they've had an extra week off. We don't know what to expect from this team.
We have no idea how they're going to adapt to the new patch that rolled in. There's been some rumors that they've been slow to adapt to it.
And so across the globe, Twitch viewers watch Sabiobi and his teammates take a live stage, just 12 athletes at 12 computers to face Philadelphia.
Sabiobi!
And when the action began, as usual, the Excelsior were on their game.
Pine's got the blade out though, already two kills, looking for the third as well, but Neptuno's beating his wings, trying to get away, succeeds in surviving a little while longer, but now New York have set themselves up. The rest of the team is dying here for Philly, and everybody's gone. Just like that, New York, in the span of a couple of seconds, wipe out the defense.
But then...
That is a crushing and brutal attack round from the Philadelphia Fusion.
Yeah, that may have been the most one-sided round of Overwatch I've ever seen.
Philadelphia Fusion is going to the Grand Finals!
The season started! New York's first loss was to Philadelphia Fusion.
Whoa, that was unexpected. And for the Excelsior faithful, crushing. And for the young players, a painful lesson in the vagaries of elite competition. Suddenly, the Excelsior weren't shooting stars, but fallen ones. And so, like countless pro teams before them, they were left to relive their failure and seek redemption next year. After the big defeat, our producer Michael Loewinger, the mastermind of this episode, managed to track down Sabiobi.
Why do you think New York Excelsior wasn't able to win?
Our team was, we got used to winning. Winning like kind of felt natural to us. That won't happen ever again. And we'll play every game like our best.
Natural humility, very Sabiobi. But what about the patch? The changes to the game outline called the meta. Mike pressed Sabiobi, but then something odd happened. The team's PR guy, who was overwatching the interview, intervened.
I know that some people have been saying that it was the new meta that threw...
We don't want to talk about that.
You don't want to talk about the meta?
No.
Okay.
Overwatch. It's digital, it's Twitched, it's a whole new culture. But it's run by and for the money man. So, yeah, like they say, a pro sport like any other.
Coming up, Twitch IRL, paying streamers to play the game of real life.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Now we're heading into Twitch's lesser precinct, not esports, but IRL, in real life. And I start with a conversation with a friend down the hall. So, Chad Abumrad of Radiolab.
Yes.
How much do you interact with people on a digital platform? Facebook, Twitter, comments, any of that. How much?
As little as I can manage.
How come?
I bumped up against my own personality, which is I'm a deep introvert. Mm. So I did do a lot of social media stuff, and then I kind of got overloaded, and I'm taking a break.
How would you feel if your success were measured by how many people were watching you working?
That is my personal definition of hell, frankly. I hate it when people look over my shoulder when I'm trying to sort out an edit or figure out the right turn of phrase.
And not just look over your shoulder, but speak loudly.
Ugh, that's just a nightmare to me. That's because I already have all those voices in my head, and I need to shush them in order to actually work. So to have them in my head and out of my head, that seems too hard.
What if this relationship with the chat was as intense as a romance, or as roiling as a romance gone bad?
You don't mean in a sexual way, do you?
I mean as emotionally intense.
Wow.
And in order for you to be successful, you'd have to return a little bit of that. But you didn't know necessarily who any of these people were, and they were both as kind as a person can be and as mean.
I'm just trying to imagine that. What are you thinking about when you ask that question?
I'm thinking about Twitch.
Huh. It's interesting. I mean, you've answered a question for me, actually. I stumbled onto Twitch, so about a year, maybe 2 years ago at this point. I took a break from Radiolab. Mm-hmm. I was super burnt out. Mm-hmm. And I just basically sat in my room for 4 months. I was trying to figure out some technical thing about a music project I was working on. At some point, I ended up on YouTube looking at a screen recording from a guy named Deadmau5, who's a kind of cheesy, like, IDM techno producer, but very successful.
Electronic dance music.
Yes. And he used a particular program that I was trying to learn, and so for some reason I ended up sitting in front of a recording of his screen and watching him work. It's unedited, and so you're watching someone sort of click, click, edit, edit, move a sound, move it back, stretch it. No, that didn't work. Throw it away, open up a new session. At some point, he just stopped and went to the bathroom for 10 minutes, and you're just looking at an empty screen.
And you stayed.
I stayed for some reason. I was like, I found it mesmerizing because you were watching someone think, you know? Like, usually what you experience on the other end of any media is some sort of edited, pre-packaged, mediated thing, and it was deeply meditative. It adjusted time in a certain way. And so I watched this whole thing, and then I call up the next one, and I called up the next one, and there's like hours and hours of Deadmau5 doing this. Sometimes you can see like a little thumbnail video of the camera looking at him, and I would stare at that and be like, oh, what is that gear next to him? And And then there was, see, you just answered for me the question. There was this chat stream happening in one corner of the screen.
And this was on YouTube.
And I wasn't really sure who these people are that were chatting, but apparently I was a time-delayed member of a large community who was watching him. This is so weird. We're all watching this guy work. It's almost as intimate as sex. I mean, it's funny. I don't even like the music, but the process was so fascinating. And I started going through his discography and then going back to these Twitch screen captures where you could see him making those songs. He's playing around and then some mistake will happen that will generate an idea and you could see him latch onto it and then he starts building it out. And then you fast forward 25 minutes in the video and you're like, oh my God, there's the beat. Ooh, and he just found the bass line. It's super addictive. I spent, I would say in total, a week watching nothing but this guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's a complete asshole. And I still find the whole thing a little mystifying, but I think back to that and there's something deeply comfortable about it.
When my kids were little, we had a VCR. We'd play them tape sometimes, you know, the Neglect-O-Matic. Mm-hmm. And one day it didn't work and we opened up the drawer and they had stuck their lunch in there, which was broccoli and chicken, because they thought it would come on TV.
Just stepping out mm-hmm. of the conversation, I think that your kids putting their sandwiches into the TV is a good ending. Because what it suggests is that it's a primal desire we have. We want to interact and we want to manipulate the people on the screen. And somehow now here we are.
We understand what the screen is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. But we seem to be getting closer and closer to what my kids thought it was. You can talk to the guy on the screen. You can ensure that that guy on the screen gets a meal or not.
Yeah, yeah.
I tell Jad about VP Gloves, who crossed the country for a job offered by a guy named Joe and found himself dumped at a McDonald's in San Luis Obispo. He was already streaming, but now he was homeless. He tapped his viewers to help cover the cost of a cheap room and a meal.
So this guy was homeless and he was streaming his own homeless life and then
yes.
people started giving him money?
Right.
How did this guy get an audience to begin with? Is he a super charismatic, funny type of person? Or
he's shy, low-key. He is nice.
Wow.
There seems to be no pretense to him and also very little resistance to the influence of the people who watch him.
Hmm. So the people who watch him will say, hey, take a left, and he'll just take a left kind of thing?
Sure.
Wow. There's something kind of beautiful and kind of creepy about that. You know?
Do you want to come to, like, a little show going on?
Should we go, boys? Follow him or not? Follow him?
Follow. Follow him. We can smoke.
Are you ready to hear VP Gloves?
I am, yeah.
We managed to get Gloves and Weezer, who moderates Glove's chat, and Glove's girlfriend, Neely, into a studio. We were recording, he was streaming, and I could watch the chat weighing in. You're not nervous, are you?
A little bit.
Just introduce yourself. Who are you? How old are you? Where are you from?
Okay, I'm VP Gloves from Twitch TV. I'm 38.
You don't want to use your real name?
Alex.
Now, Alex, Gloves, produces heaps of streaming content practically every waking moment, and sometimes draws a couple thousand viewers, some of whom contribute regularly to support his life on the edge. And they've been doing it since March.
Like, every day I seem to be able to raise the money to stay indoors and eat. It just seemed like it was doable. You know, it was like long hours and whatever, but it was working out. So it felt good. I felt safe in a way, like these guys kept me safe.
Why do you think people watch you?
Some people like to just see me talk to them, just kind of hang out. Other people really like me to be out and about and interacting with other people. That's what they like. Other people like the story. Like, probably most of them only tune in when there's a level of drama. Like, when my life's at a really unstable point. Like, am I going to make the hotel goal for the day, or how am I going to eat? What's going to happen with Joe or with whoever?
Joe's the guy with the job that never materialized. He's a dark character in the saga, and he dated Glove's erstwhile best friend, Amanda. Viewers play in Glove's story like it was a sandbox. Some pay for shelter, others, just for fun, call the cops on him.
Someone once put it, I think it was Janice, said it was like playing Homeless Sky Simulator.
How does that feel?
It feels fine, I guess. I'm okay with it. I mean, it's a great improvement on my situation before.
So how did you get Weezer in your life?
He was a troll at first. I was staying at the homestead in San Luis Obispo, and someone in the stream had doxed my location, calling the hotel and just harassing me, and then basically extorted me into making Weezer a mod.
How did they extort this concession from you to add a moderator?
Because they knew my hotel and the room and stuff, so like they just put the pressure on me. Like, it's happened to me before, and it's like so embarrassing. Go down the next day and have the front desk asking, like, who was calling? Like, that guy was so rude. Like, I couldn't handle that, so I just did whatever they said.
And the idea was to pick any random viewer.
The random stranger on the phone chose him, who we don't know who it was, called me and said, Mod Weezinator.
It definitely wasn't me.
It wasn't.
We're hearing from Weezinator right now. Tell me about how you became interested in VP Glove's channel.
My friends and I usually watch gaming streams. We were just scrolling through, and he just seemed interesting at the time. I think he was promoting his flat Earth theory.
I believe the Earth, it's sort of like a cone, okay? And underneath is a giant tortoise.
He also said he was not sure where he was going to stay for the next night. So he was raising a funding goal on there. So my trolling was he was $50 short or something for his stay for the weekend.
Uh-huh.
And so we donated $50 to him. And he would write, the Earth is round, on his forehead.
Uh-huh.
And that's what he did.
So, here's the interesting twist. You decided to invite Alex to come and live with you and your wife at your home in Riverside, and he has.
We had watched him for at least 15 hours plus a day for over a month. So I work on the computer from home most of the time. So I would have his stream running on like a second monitor. It was just really intriguing to see what was going to happen with him, as well as his backstory of Joe and his friend Amanda. He would kind of promote like what's going to happen next. If something would happen, I could go there and interact with the chat and talk to people about it.
You were essentially inviting someone you'd never actually met into your home for an indefinite period.
We didn't necessarily feel like we didn't know him because we had been watching him for, at that point, maybe 2 months now, a large portion of the day, and we wanted to help him out.
There seems to be a fair amount of skepticism that I'm seeing on the feed here. Things about a Porsche and never sleeping outside, an emoji that's represents a resident dreamer or something. I mean, I know that I'm out of my depth. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, there is a lot going on in chat. And through the course of meeting him, I've realized that chat is its own beast. At the end of the day, though, I genuinely believe if we met them in real life, the majority of them would be the nicest people there is. And I believe that because we have met other people from the chat. Their identity has been released to the chat room. And when that happens, and when you're being your real self, then you are nicer. And a lot of the people in the chat play this role of a troll, and they talk a lot of crap to each other. I guess I'm somewhat the same way. When I'm just in chat, I start yelling at people in the chat because it's fun and entertaining. But then, you know, if you met me in real life, I'm actually fairly calm and nice. And, you know, I wouldn't hate on anybody. But the community inside the chat room when you're not face-to-face with somebody is very different.
So what do you do as a moderator? Do you block people?
It's very rare that you let people just kind of go off and say whatever they want and do whatever they want in the chat. And that's what a moderator is for. In Alex's case, his chat and his community kind of feeds off of the craziness that's happening. And a lot of it is borderline not acceptable. But because of the drama and situation that he's in, those are the type of people that like to stick around. So he kind of let it be a little bit less strict.
Hi, Neely. I see you sitting right next to him there.
Hi.
How did you guys meet?
He was out streaming one night in downtown Riverside, and a couple friends of mine had dragged me out to one of the bars, and we were watching him walk around with the camera and a giant rainbow-colored hula hoop. And then he kept kind of walking back and forth in front of us, and I started yelling at him about the hula hoop. And he came over, and so I basically left my friends and wandered off with the stranger down the street.
Jad was fascinated by Neely's entry into the story because it was engineered by the chat, which had saddled gloves with the hula hoop and the directive to catch a woman's eye.
Someone told him to do a hula hoop public display of humiliation that ended up getting him
the girl
to meet somebody.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so complicated. That's so complicated.
Actually, it was chat that asked her out. He was instructed to hand her his phone, and
oh,
she could see
God.
The chat saying, go out with him, go out with him.
Wow, it's like in every moment, it's like kind of sweet and kind of abusive. It's like, go do this humiliating thing, go out with him. It's very, it's like kind of hard to parse, you know?
Yep, we walked down the street with the hoop, found a place that would let him in with an expired ID, and we sat there and we talked with chat.
What did chat say?
Jeez. Telling him to kiss me.
Hey, camera, hey. I'm out of money. Give the guy a kiss. I gotta go to bed.
For real? This is not how I'm going to first kiss gloves.
Yeah, sorry about that. They want
you're
the,
sorry
the
about it until it works, though, right?
No, like, exactly. That's not what this is about. It's just they want the payoff so bad. But, like, I'm just... This is nice. This is fine. Trust me. That's not what I'm... You get it.
I believe you. You're a homeless hipster that takes your gigantic hula hoop for walks at nighttime.
They made me do that. Like, I just do what these guys tell me to do, pretty much.
So you're a cuck for these guys.
Yes.
On the internet.
I mean...
As you heard at first, they really liked her and really liked kind of having her around. And then some people just didn't like her anymore. And so they were trying to bribe me to break up with her, basically. The level of control was going, you know, up another level.
Some people probably think that they own the relationship because they got it going.
I think that's exactly how they feel. It's a weird position to be in because, obviously, I do feel like a weird obligation, whatever.
Why? I mean, how much of your life is yours?
It doesn't seem like a lot because, you know, they saved me. So... But yeah,
I mean, if you assert yourself, do you think you'll lose that support?
It's definitely possible that I would lose that support, definitely.
I am going to say Janis Joplin so that that person will give you $20.
Thank you.
So after some of the people in chat started turning on me, they were saying I was making the stream boring, other stuff. I went back over old videos, and it looks to me like things come in waves where, you know, they're really encouraging, but then you get a few people that will come in and sort of dominate, not be happy with the content that he's making.
So things can't go too good for me. Like, I can't be too happy or else it gets boring. We've got to take that away.
Probably people have offered you work, I'm guessing.
There are people that say they want to hire you and stuff, but it's always been like a weird, elaborate trolling attempt to like get a lot of attention. They don't see a stream broadcasting as a job and they think it's easy and they don't like the idea of you making money doing this, but yet they still watch, which is weird.
A lot of people were very supportive when his situation was more dire and he was in need of just the basics. He was just literally alone on the street. The people that followed him then aren't willing to give up that story. He's a real human being and wants real friends and wants a real life. And sometimes the chat does feel like they own it because they have donated and supported him so long.
So, Alex, what if you didn't need the financial support anymore? Would you still need the community support? Would you still need the chat?
Yeah, I think there is something that I'm chasing on here, some kind of experience or some kind of like connection with the audience. Yeah, it's not just money. There's something else. Feel like a real closeness with them. It's like you feel cared about. It's hard. I don't know. It's just something. Yeah, there's some kind of like a magic.
Well, thank you, all three of you. It's really helped me understand this, so much appreciated.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I mean, thank you, yeah.
There's a magic. He said he felt cared for, but nothing comes for free. As Weezer said, often we're not as good when we're anonymous. Twitch offers one new thing, the power of the chat to be heard in real time. The next advance will be when every member of the chat can be seen in real time. Every new entertainment exposes a little more of who we are as a species. If we could see ourselves in action, who knows who we could be? Twitch, do you feel me?
I have everything. I got you guys in one hand. I got Neely in the other. It's like I have everything. I'm snuggling with both of you. We're all snuggling together in the bed. Don't you guys feel it? All of us together? Or maybe out here, I'll bring you guys closer for extra snuggliness.
One more story before we go. Not about Twitch, but about our dominant connection platform. Ever in the news and in our personal data. I'm talking about Facebook, a short preview of a fascinating new report from Radiolab's Simon Adler.
Down the hall from you folks here at OTM.
You betcha. We see you running around like fire ants on bits of carrion.
Yes, that is I.
Begin by telling me about the project, which dovetails so beautifully with our general bailiwick.
The episode actually came out this past Thursday. Whether you know it or not, for the past 10 years, Facebook has been writing a hyper-detailed rulebook of what you can and can't say or see on Facebook. And at this point, they are enforcing this rulebook on all 2.2 billion of us users.
And what drew you to the story?
Sort of the tension here that drew me to this was trying to understand how you take something as abstract and lofty as the First Amendment and the American free speech tradition, and how do you boil that down into what essentially has become a series of if-then statements?
As in?
If there is a nipple or areola present in a photograph, it constitutes a naked breast, and so therefore, because Facebook does not allow for nudity, that photo has to come down. Unless there is a baby present in the photo that appears to be a toddler or younger and has recently finished breastfeeding, is in the act of breastfeeding, or is just about to breastfeed.
I think I see the problem. Yes.
One of the most controversial and fascinating examples was back in 2017, The Guardian leaked a training document about these guidelines. Essentially, it was a set of PowerPoint slides. And on one of the slides, they state clearly, Facebook will protect white men from hate speech, but it will not protect black children from hate speech.
Oh, yes. This is from your episode. You were talking to Jad and Robert about this. And it kind of boils down in the end to modifiers, parts of speech.
This is Monica Bicker, Facebook's head of policy.
So traditionally, we allowed speech once there was some other word in it that made it about something other than a protected characteristic.
In Facebook jargon, these are referred to as a non-protected modifier.
I just need to lie down when I hear
that. Just means literally nothing to me. Give us an example of this.
Sure.
So traditionally, if you said, I don't like this religion, cab drivers.
cab driver would be the non-protected modifier because employment is not a protected category.
Right.
And here's where things get a little wonky. So the rule stated that when you add this non-protected modifier to the protected category, in this case, the cab driver's religion,
we would allow it because we can't assume that you're hating this person because of his religion. You actually just may not like cab drivers.
So in the case of black children, children is modifying the protected category of black.
Mm-hmm.
And so children trumps black?
Age is a non-protected category.
Okay.
And so children becomes a non-protected modifier, and their childness trumps their blackness. You can say whatever you want about black children. Whereas white men, you've got race and gender both protected, so you can't attack them.
That's just a bizarre rule.
Yeah, I'll say it's, you know, I guess you can't attack black men either, or white women, or black women.
Well, yeah, so talking to some of the folks involved in writing these rules, the thought was, okay, do we want to make age a protected class? And they decided no, because then essentially, among other things, you wouldn't be able to make fun of a toddler on Facebook. If a toddler is doing something stupid and you say, God, isn't he a stupid little toddler? That would effectively be hate speech by that rule, and therefore no one could write that, and they didn't want to do that.
This is why you can't use an algorithm. Ultimately, you need someone with an eye on that.
Back in 2008, when this rule book started being written, there were 12 people in Menlo Park doing this work. Fast forward 10 years, we're now looking at somewhere around 16,000 people doing that work.
We spoke to Adrian Chen about 4 years ago about the unseen world of moderators. And apparently there was an attempt to employ a lot of people in India, but culturally they were further away from the U.S. than people in the Philippines.
Hyderabad was the first place Facebook decided to start offshoring their content moderation. These were still Facebook employees, mind you, so it wasn't being outsourced, but they were building an office in Hyderabad, and they were going to send a lot of the nudity images flagged as being nude to these folks in Hyderabad. So they put them through the two-week training period, and they give them their rule that they're judging against, and it says things like no male or female genitalia, no breasts, no butt cracks. And then they left this release valve in the rule at that point. This is in 2010, saying, and take down anything else that is sexually explicit.
Mm.
And what they found within moments of these folks going live was you had these moderators in India who were taking down pictures of people kissing on their wedding day because this definition of sexually explicit was so culturally bound. And so essentially the story of the development of these rules is them cranking the screws down on these tighter and tighter definitions so that culture and moderator judgment is not allowed into the equation at all.
This is a project, I imagine, that can never end. Is there any point where this is actually going to work?
I know everyone wants to hate Facebook. They're not great, but like, this is an intractable problem that they have to try to solve, but they never knew that they were creating. And I walk away from this reporting feeling that they will inevitably fail, but they have to try, and we should all be rooting for them. Because the alternative is you just have more situations like that in Sri Lanka or Myanmar where they are goofing up and people are dying as a result of it.
To hear Simon Adler's full story, which is called Post No Evil, head over to radiolab.org or the podcast app of your choice. That's it for this week's show. Producer Michael Loewinger did the heavy lifting on this one. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Leia Fetter, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Asta Chaturvedi, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Sam Baer.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.